of comedy or compare notes about careers so far. The vibe was more like a fraternity. When you're in college, you don't talk about getting a job when you graduate. You just have fun and live in the moment. That was how it felt on the Wild West show. I avoided talking about what would happen when it was over. Most likely I was going to go back to the penguin suit. I hoped that the cachet of this tour would lead to better paying gigs for me. But I thought that before and been disappointed. I put my future fears aside for 30 days and concentrated on having a great time with those guys, doing comedy in those venues, and sleeping and living on that bus. I knew it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience that I would probably never repeat. Looking back, my memories of the Wild West comedy show are only golden. It was a constant stream of fun. I knew a return to the Four Seasons loomed when it was over, but I pushed that to the back of my mind and really soaked up every day like it was my last. And then the last day came. The final performance was in my hometown and Vince's, and I had my family and friends there. Returning to Chicago with Vince Vaughn and making my parents proud of me was a watershed moment. We'd had some shaky exchanges when they expressed doubt about my career choice. Now, for the first time in 7 years, my parents had a sense that I was on the right track. The documentary director, Ari Sandell, an Oscar winner for his short film, West Bank Story, interviewed my parents. My father said, "He's gonna make it. I don't know when, but he's gonna make it." It all came together for me that night. The vote of confidence from my family, the excitement of my friends, the bonds I'd made on the road with the other comedians and the crew. I felt deeply connected to everyone in my life that night. And then it was over. We did a final interview for Ari talking about what the tour meant for us and how we felt about it coming to an end. Of course I got emotional and unsuccessfully fought back the tears saying, "I'm kind of choked up because it's a lot of emotion going on. I don't want to be a pussy or nothing, but I loved every minute of this, man. I just don't want it to end." They all reached out with a shoulder squeeze. I really did love those guys. I was overwhelmed by the experience, the friendship, the adventure. The joy poured out through my tear ducts. It had nowhere else to go. That fit of sentimentality would come back to haunt me 3 years later when the Wild West comedy show 30 Days and 30 Nights, Hollywood to the Heartland, was finally released in theaters. My parents and friends flew to L.A. for the premiere. When my buddies saw the crying scene, they sank into their seats. Out of all of them, I'm the most emotional, but they'd never seen me cry before. At the after party, they tore me to shreds about it. From that day on, the phrase, "I don't want to be a pussy or nothing," has come up in conversation with them. Then my buddies start laughing at me so hard, the tears run down their faces, and I say, "Who's crying now, motherfuckers?" I made some money on the tour, about $5,000. It was more than I would have made at the Four Seasons in a month by far. I decided that with this cushion, I didn't have to rush back there. I gave myself permission not to. The next month, I landed a corporate gig at a sales conference in L.A. I got $3,500 for that. So now my cushion was growing. On top of that, I had newfound credibility with comedy club owners because of the Vince Vaughn seal of approval. Being tapped to be on that tour was good enough for them. Seeing an opportunity, I suggested to my agent, "Why don't we see if we could shore up a gig at a comedy club in Dallas? I'd just been on tour there. My name was fresh in their minds. I figured the owners would think, let's see what this guy's got on his own." I had the taste of the all comedy, all the time life, and I wanted more. "Whatever work comes in, I'll take it," I said to my agent. "I don't care if it's a week in the sticks, 6 shows, 3 on Saturday, whatever it is, I'll do it." Miraculously, the calls did come in, with me as the headliner. Before long, I was back on the road doing gigs all over the country, begging off shifts at the Four Seasons every week. After a year of this, the manager of the lounge called me and said, "Listen, man, we need to know if you're coming back to work, because if you're not, we need to give away your locker space." This was it. What I consider a turning point in my life and career. If I held on to that locker, I'd have a safety net. If the gigs dried up, I'd have somewhere to go and a way to earn a living. Or I could quit the day job and go hard on the comedy circuit and continue to build a fan base and improve my act. It would be a risk. In my 8 years on the edges of the comedy world, I've seen guys with huge potential and big crowds flame out or burn out. I'd also see people who would dip their toe in halfway and never put everything they had into it. It was an easy decision to make. Took about 5 seconds. I told the Four Seasons manager, "I'm not coming back. Whatever's in my locker, just give it away." My locker was small, a half locker on the bottom row. I had no idea what was in there, probably some spare change, a couple of pens, a pair of worn-out work shoes. I never invested in good shoes, probably a mistake for someone on his feet for 8 hours a day. The heel of my shoe would often be loose. It would flop around like a flip-flop, but it still worked. I think those cheap shoes fucked up my feet permanently. But better shoes would have been kind of a defeat, like resigning myself to being a waitress the rest of my life. Any money I made was spent on doing comedy and paying back my father. Beat-up shoes and flat feet didn't stop me from making the biggest leap of faith so far in my life. On September 12, 2006, I left the job that had supported my dream for 8 years. I took a gamble, and this time, it paid off. Chapter 6, Hungry Heart. By late 2008, I've been doing comedy in Los Angeles for over a decade. Thanks to my associations with Dice and Vince, I had enough clout to book comedy clubs all over the country. I even did a tour in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, Qatar, and Egypt, with Ahmed Ahmed and some other guys. I was working full-time as a comedian, having some degree of success, and making a decent living. I was in a nice place professionally. Personally? Romantically? I was nowhere. In all my time in L.A., I had dated here and there, but nothing serious. Before the ball started rolling with my comedy, I didn't have enough money to take someone out. And once I was coming up, I traveled 52 weekends out of the year. I was focused on my career. It sounds like an L.A. douchebag thing to say, "I'm too busy for a relationship." But I was always on the road. I would leave town on a Wednesday, come back on a Monday, every single week. What woman would be okay with that? I had to take the work to make money and build my reputation. The only long-term relationship I had while living in L.A. was with a woman in Dallas. I met her while I was on the Wild West tour, but she hadn't come to my show. Me and the other guys went to a bar afterward, and I met her there. We had a great time talking and laughing that night, and we started writing emails and texts to each other. Then we started having actual phone conversations. A year went by, and we evolved into traveling to see each other. Either she came to L.A. for a few days, or I went to Dallas. She was a nice girl, funny and cool. The slow pace and the distance between us allowed us to get to know one another in an old-fashioned way by writing and talking. We had a good time together, but kind of always knew that it wasn't going to go any further, for a few reasons, only one of which was our living in two different states. After 4 years, I decided there was no point in continuing, so we ended it. I didn't change dramatically after the breakup, but it felt different to be single. Part of the reason the long-distance relationship had worked for me so long was it took the pressure off. I didn't have to look too closely at how I organized my life to prevent a serious connection from developing. It wasn't like I woke up and said, "Seb, you're 35. You've never had a committed relationship in your entire adult life. It's time." But I did feel a shift in how I was thinking about what my next relationship would be like. For starters, she would have to live in L.A. I put out some feelers for fix-ups to one of my best friends, also my personal trainer, John Petrelli. John and I met on the set of Days of Our Lives doing extra work in 1998. We were on lunch break and began talking. I never met anybody more annoyed at the world than myself. He's from upstate New York, from an Italian family, a great guy who would take the shirt off his back for you. We hit it off immediately. He comes across like the ultimate man. He hunts his own food, he does jiu-jitsu, he's a martial artist, a builder, a fisherman, and a survivalist. You could drop him in the woods naked with a piece of string and a toothpick, and he would emerge next week, well-fed and wearing bearskin. In other words, John is the total opposite of me. I asked him, "Do you train any good-looking women?" He said, "Actually, I have one, but she comes in early, around 7 a.m. I usually had my session at the gym at 10, but I said, "All right, schedule me right after her so I could see what she looks like." Yes, I plotted with John to scope out a complete stranger. He had made her sound pretty and funny. I just wanted to meet her. I thought I couldn't be too obvious about it, or she'd be turned off immediately. It had to seem organic, almost accidental. And I had to look my best. Even though I was showing up at the gym first thing in the morning, when most people were just rolling out of bed into their workout clothes, I got up at 6 a.m. to do a full body prep. Hair, skin, nails, shave. I may have got a little over-involved with the grooming, like I was doing a bodybuilding competition and not a casual workout on a Tuesday. I showed up around 7:55, right at the end of her session, as John and I had planned. He said, "Hey, Sebastian, 5 minutes early? I love it. Lana and I are just finishing up. Lana, this is my old friend Sebastian. Sebastian, meet my client Lana." Lana and I shook hands and said, "Nice to meet you." And then she left. Once she was out of earshot, John asked, "So?" I said, "She's cute. Really cute. Blonde, petite, with a smile that lit up the room, sweet, friendly, with a surprising southern accent. I learned later she grew up in Memphis, Tennessee." I was about to ask him how to proceed to get to know her better when John put a damper on it. "She had a boyfriend," he said. Oh, well, that changed things. We talked about it while training. John started stretching me out, pushing my leg to one side, and his fingers slid off my skin. "Why the hell are you so greasy, man?" he asked. "It's baby oil." "You put baby oil on your legs at 7 in the morning to make a good impression on a girl?" I mean, listen, in hindsight, it does seem ridiculous. I asked Lana years later if she noticed how sexy and shiny my legs were when we first met. She nodded and said, "I just thought you were so out of shape that you were sweating before you even began working out." I wasn't going to move in on her if she had a boyfriend, but over the next few weeks, John hinted to me that he didn't think that Lana and Mr. X were going to last. Apparently, they had met at the University of Tennessee and came to L.A. together, but there was trouble in paradise. I told John to let me know if they broke up, which they did a few months later, but then she took up with some other guy. John delivered the intel. "Good news. Lana broke up with the college boyfriend. Bad news. She's seeing someone else." In December, I started seeing Lana around the gym by accident for real. She'd switched to the 9 a.m. training sessions, and I was at my usual 10 a.m. slot. When we crossed paths, we'd say, "Hey, how you doing?" I would throw in a compliment or whatnot, something like, "Your hair looks good today." She would say, "Thanks," always polite, but she gave me no sign of interest. She remembers me saying once, "You look like you lost some weight." And she replied, "Oh, I guess I was fat before." I was just saying anything to start up a conversation, but in hindsight, That's not something you should say to a lady. I decided to ask her out anyway. I told John I was going to do it, and he sussed her out about it with the subtlety of a sledgehammer. My client Sebastian wants to take you on a date, he said. This information came out of nowhere for her. Although I've been complimenting her and smiling hard for a week, she had no idea I was flirting until John said something. She replied to John, "Tell Sebastian I don't date anybody who has a higher body fat percentage than me." She was joking. Her comedy's so dry. All of John's clients had just had their body fat tested, and she knew that there was no way mine was less than hers. Next time I saw her, I got on a treadmill next to her and started running alongside and said, "Word on the street is that you don't date anybody with more than 20% body fat." I don't fall into that category, but I could eventually get there. "But in the meantime, would you like to go out to dinner with me?" Lana laughed and said, "Okay." We decided on Sushi Roku on 3rd Street in L.A. Right on time, I picked her up at her place, a real cute house. She opened up the door and said, "I'm still getting ready. Come on in." I went in, expecting to wait in the living room or the kitchen for her to finish, maybe meet her roommates or something. But she brought me right into the bedroom and told me to have a seat on the bed while she put on her makeup right in front of me. I might have said, "Okay, we just met." It just felt too friendly, too intimate, too soon. There wasn't the barrier that should have been up, or at least had always been up on first dates with other women. Normally, you don't get the peek behind the curtain right away. Lana's complete lack of mystery had me baffled. I know now that my wife has a resting smile face. But that night, her grin had an edge. Apparently, I made her nervous, and yet she invited me into her bedroom after 30 seconds. Another thing that confused me? She didn't have any roommates. The whole house was hers. She was barely out of college, and she had her own home? I thought, what's going on here? It was no dump, either. House was quaint, artsy, full of paintings, sculptures, eclectic objects, shelves full of books, crystal jobbies, a painted chalkboard with doodles and drawings, cool lighting fixtures. The whole place was beautifully designed with custom-made furniture. The vintage chairs were different from the upholstered couch, with mismatched decorative pillows like they had been picked out separately. Where I grew up, you went to Wick's Furniture and just bought the complete set. John had warned me that Lana's family was well off, but until I saw her house, I didn't know the extent. When I was 25, I was in a dark one-bedroom in full view of a couch humper. So we came from different worlds. That was okay. I'd met all kinds of people since I moved to L.A., and I wasn't worried about her background or intimidated by it. It just added another layer of intrigue. I wanted to hear more about growing up in the South, which I knew nothing about, and how she decided to move to L.A. I could tell her my stories about Chicago. We'd have a lot to talk about. But as soon as we got in my car to drive to the restaurant, she stopped talking. We sat down at the table, and still she didn't speak. Not even to say what she wanted to eat. I ordered for both of us. Throughout the entire meal, I did all the talking. She was polite and engaged, always smiling. But there was nothing coming out of her mouth. I ran through a 90-minute extended monologue. It was agony. I even dipped into doing my own act on the first date to fill the time. I could tell she was nervous or shy beyond belief, but why? It wasn't like we hadn't spoken before. I'd just been in her bedroom. After sushi, we went to Pinkberry at the Grove, an outdoor shopping mall. She still didn't talk, but it was easier to not have a conversation while walking around in a crowded place. By the time I dropped her off, I'd completely run out of material. The next day, John asked me, "How'd it go?" I said, "She didn't speak." "Lana? Lana Gomez. What? I can't get her to shut up." I go, "Yeah, well, she's a sweet girl," I said. "Really nice, polite, but not much to say." After thinking about it for a week, I chalked her silence up to extreme shyness or nerves. It was worth trying again. I called her, and she told me she was at work. She was an artist, the resident painter at Kelly Wurstler Boutique, her favorite interior design company in L.A. She was getting her feet wet and learning from Kelly, a woman Lana admired, who was and still is one of her biggest inspirations. We had a fantastic chat on the phone with some great banter. So why was she so quiet face to face? Then she admitted, "I've never been on a first date before." At the time, Lana was 25, and she'd been a serial monogamist. She and her friends would all go out to parties together. Socializing was more communal. They would go out to a bar or to somebody's house with 16 people. Her generation didn't date per se. They hung out. That's not how I rolled. I love dating, especially first dates. I've been on dozens of them. Mister, I'll take you out, we'll have a nice dinner and a cocktail afterwards. The first proper date Lana had ever been on, when a guy picked her up, took her to dinner, and brought her home, was with me. She added, "I was intimidated. All I know about you is what I found on Google." Predating Googling, the curse of the digital age. She'd read some interviews with me and found videos on YouTube. Not good. Since Lana was so silent, I was drawing straws and had gone into my act in order to have any conversation, and she said she just watched the clips earlier that day on the computer. She had seen how critical of other people I was in my comedy, and she was afraid if she'd say something that I'd be offended or I would judge her harshly. She didn't want to give me material that would later end up in my act. The irony is, now I get material from her constantly, and she's in my act every night. "I was shy," she said. "I have no idea why. I'm never like that." We kept talking, and I started to tune into her deadpan sarcasm and dry humor over the phone, and I was really liking it. On our next date, we went to go see Frost Nixon with Frank Langella and Michael Sheen. It was a weird choice for a second date. The movie wasn't a formulaic romantic comedy, although Frost and Nixon butted heads in the beginning and got together by the end. Kind of. The whole time, I was worried about what Lana and I were going to talk about after. Lana wasn't born until 9 years after Nixon resigned. She barely knew anything about him. I suggested the movie because I like historical films, but in hindsight, maybe I should have picked something even remotely sexy. I could tell that I needed to implement something fun to get the night going, so we got margaritas after the movie, and the conversation flowed well. On our third date, we went on a hike to Runyon Canyon. Lana had told me that she'd been a competitive gymnast throughout high school. I'd seen her on the treadmill at the gym, and I knew she was in incredible shape, not to mention 10 years younger than me. And I was doing my best. I wasn't in bad shape, just ask John Travolta, but I'm more of an indoor kind of person generally. When you first start dating, you want to feel like you could impress the girl. As we hiked up the mountain, I quickly realized that this was not going to happen. I didn't have the stamina to keep up with her. At one point, she grabbed my hand. While trying not to overtly gasp for breath, I had the presence of mind to think, "Oh, wow, how sweet. She wants to hold hands." My heart beat a little faster, which is saying a lot. But then she said, "Come on!" She wasn't being romantic. She grabbed my hand to tug me along faster. Lana wasn't going to slow down for me, and she expected me to pick up the pace. This dynamic, her pushing me, or pulling me to push myself, has been a reoccurring theme in our relationship. When I grew up, I did some things, homework, school projects, half-assed. I put effort into things I cared about, like my style. But otherwise, I was okay with okay. Not Lana. She puts extra effort into everything, from hiking a mountain to wrapping a gift to raising our daughter. She's a born perfectionist with an eye for detail. I might look at, say, a hotel room and think, "It's all right." But Lana will dissect it and say, "The color's off. The couch makes no sense over there." After 9 years together, now I, too, walk into a hotel room and notice 5 things I changed to improve it. In a way, Lana has made me even more judgmental. In my single life, I'd ask, "How can I make it?" In my married life, I ask, "How can I make it better?" Before the Runyon Canyon hike, I never would have imagined I could practically run up a mountain. I'm not a perfectionist like she is, by any means. But when I watch her work extra hard at the gym, or go the extra mile in an area of her life, I feel like I have to try to match her, or I'll never catch up. When we got to the top of the mountain that day, I looked at her, and she looked at me. I was gasping, dizzy, and sweating. Then I saw the Holy Grail, a water fountain. I ran over, I took a sip. Then I looked behind me and realized there was a line of people, holding dogs. Lana smiled sweetly as she said, "Oh my God, I can't believe you drank out of that fountain where the dogs all drink." We didn't kiss that day, or on the fourth date, or on the fifth date. I definitely, desperately wanted to kiss her, but I was still getting to know her and her sense of humor. She wasn't demonstrably affectionate and never gave me any obvious cues that said kiss me. She kept saying yes to dates, but I wasn't sure how she felt about me. I asked myself, does she even like me? Where are we going with this? Lana could run a mile in 8 minutes flat, but the pace of our relationship was agonizingly slow. To be honest with you, it was strange to me. I never waited 7 days to kiss anybody in my life. But for whatever the reason, lunging in, mouth open, didn't feel like the right thing to do with her. I was waiting for that right moment. About a month into our whatever it was, we were at her house, hanging out on the couch, talking. It was getting pretty late. I was going to go to Dubai the next day, and I had to go home and pack, so I said, "I got to go." She said, "Okay." We made eye contact, held it, and without words or any nonverbal communication, we leaned in toward each other and kissed for the first time. It was a passionate kiss, but I understood it wasn't going any further. Clothes were not going to come flying off. After a few minutes, we separated and said goodbye. In my car driving home, I was reeling. What just happened? Does this mean we're together? Does she like me? I could not figure it out. To this day, there are moments when my wife mystifies me. Keeps things interesting. The Dubai trip was an all-expense-paid 5-day gig to perform at a wedding. The groom's father, a real estate mogul in India, was paying me 15 grand for one night's work. It was the most I'd been paid in my career. They'd originally wanted Russell Peters, an Indian comedian, but he wasn't available or asked for too much. I guess I was next on their list, and I jumped at that opportunity. I just had a breakthrough with Lana, though, and leaving town immediately after that didn't feel right. Although the timing wasn't ideal, I somehow managed to enjoy the unlimited champagne and flatbed seat in my first-class cabin, also paid for by the groom's father. The flight attendants on Emirates wear those adorable little red hats with the white veil, and they're always smiling. They were nothing like the flight attendants on American Airlines who look at you like they want to kill you for asking for a blanket. After the 17-hour flight, I was picked up in a limo and taken to the Burj Al Arab Jumeirah, a.k.a. the most luxurious hotel in the world. It looks like a sailboat in the sky. I was shown into a luxury suite with panoramic views of Dubai and introduced to my private butler. It was so over-the-top opulent. Everything was silk or crystal. There was a mirror over the bed. The Burj Al Arab is called a 7-star hotel. There's no such thing. They just made that up to sound unrivaled. I, for one, have never seen anything like this before. It was kind of gaudy, to be honest. Lavish, but also tacky. The wedding planner came by to check on me and told me about all the activities planned for the guests throughout the weekend. Dune buggy rides, surfing school on artificial waves, hot air ballooning. I listened to the list of my options, but all I could think was, if only Lana were here. When a relationship is just kicking off, you want to be joined at the hip to share everything. In that phase of love, going food shopping at Ralph's is a crazy fun adventure. And here I was in an exotic location, living in insane luxury, but it felt empty. We weren't even 2 months in, and I missed her already. I passed on the dune buggies and surfing. I didn't know anyone, and I didn't want to be a fifth wheel. The idea of showing up at some activity with the wedding guests mouthing, "Who's this guy?" to each other was enough to keep me away. Besides that, I don't like to interact with the audience before I do comedy. When I have corporate gigs, the organizers often ask me to sit down for dinner with the company's staff beforehand. But I can't eat a plate of chicken and rice and make small talk with strangers and then say, "Excuse me, I gotta go on stage." Whether it's a high school auditorium or a Broadway theater, the audience is always separated from the actors with a curtain. It creates a divide between reality and the willful illusion of the show. You don't want to see the actors putting on their makeup and costumes beforehand. To enjoy the experience of the show, you need to believe that the stage is another world. I feel the same way about comedy. Mingling with the audience or even walking through the casino before a show spoils the mystery. I want the audience to think I was airdropped onto the stage, like, how'd he get there? Getting on a camel ride with the wedding guests beforehand would just seem to ruin it. The only perk I took my host up on was a massage. Even then, I didn't feel comfortable taking advantage. I got the 50-minute basic rubdown instead of the hour-and-a-half four-handed hot rock aromatherapy treatment with the bells and whistles. I kept thinking they'd look at the bill and say, "The fucking comedian got an hour and a half massage?" In truth, they probably wouldn't have cared or even noticed. I could have spa treatments dawn to dusk, and no one would have batted an eye. I felt guilty about using the butler. My first night, he asked, "Would you like me to draw a bath?" What would that entail? Turning on the faucet and putting some soap in there? What the hell was he gonna do? I declined that too. I drew my own bath, and I shoveled all the Hermes bath products into my suitcase. I spent much of that weekend alone in my suite or at the pool by myself. But I wasn't lonely. I was communicating with Lana the whole time. Of course, it would have been much more fun if she had actually been there, but it sufficed to send her photos and videos with "Holy shit, will you look at this?" captions. The way my wife grew up, she'd seen luxury hotels and was very well traveled. She even did a semester at sea in college, studying on a ship for a few months, visiting 10 different countries. She'd gone to Cambodia in college. The farthest I've gotten was Cancun. I don't think she had the same shock and awe reaction of the Burj Al Arab that I did, but she had never been there and was loving my updates. Being in that otherworldly place, performing at a wedding, made me think of all the meals and vacations I hope to have one day with a wife and a family. Since Lana was on my mind, I put her in the role of bride. I've never done that before with any other girlfriend. We'd only just kissed once, and it was too early to go there mentally, but instead of being scared, I liked what I imagined. I could see it with her. When I got home, the slow pace of our relationship suddenly hit the gas. We were together constantly, spending most nights at her place. Every Saturday I was in town, we'd lie out all day by her pool. At night, we tried every restaurant in the city. I went from, "Does she even like me?" to falling in love in just a few weeks. What had finally brought us together was being 8,300 miles apart. Lana and I had been an official couple for about 2 months when she told me her mother and stepfather were coming to L.A. from their home in Naples, Florida, and they wanted to meet me. She previously described her large blended family. Barry, Lana's father, had passed away suddenly, tragically, when she was 17. A few years later, her mother Simone married Scott. Simone had been married before Barry and had 2 kids from that marriage, Lana's half-brother and half-sister. Scott had also been married before Simone and had 4 children from that marriage. Although Lana was the only child of Simone and Barry, she had 2 half-siblings and 4 step-siblings, along with 9 half-step-nieces and nephews. Serafina, our baby daughter, already has a lot of cousins. I didn't grow up with a large or blended family. The Maniscalcos of Arlington Heights are a small clan, and we're full-blood related. My parents were only married to each other, until that ended unexpectedly several years ago. My sister's my sister, no qualifiers. We're all Catholic. Lana's Jewish, but some of her siblings aren't. I needed a chart to figure all this out. As complicated as her family was, everyone got along. They were close like my family. The feelings were the same, even if the Brady Bunch circumstances were wildly different. Meeting her parents was a major step, one I had rarely taken with any girlfriend before. I knew how close Lana was with her mom and stepfather, and how important it was for me to win their approval. She downplayed the upcoming meeting, but it was a big deal. The key to making a good impression was to find common ground. How was I, a middle-class Italian guy from Illinois, going to connect with Lana's golf-loving, wealthy parents from Florida? They might be stuck-up snobs and look down on me and my background. Or they might be warm and accepting. I had no idea. All I knew was that if they didn't like me, it could be a deal-breaker. The plan was to have dinner at Chinois on Main, Wolfgang Puck's restaurant in Santa Monica. Nowadays, Chinois is one of my favorite restaurants, but at the time, it was new to me. Everything was new. New relationship, new restaurant, new potential in-laws. They offered to pick me up, but as a man, I could not accept the offer. I had to meet them there. I don't like talking to people from the back seat. I can't see their faces or gauge how they're reacting. It's just not ideal. I want to engage them in a conversation while seated across the table. It was the way I preferred to do it. I also wore glasses because I thought that would make me look more intelligent. Scott, her stepdad, went to Stanford, for God's sakes. First impression? Mine? Simone was funny, sweet, and easy to get along with. Scott came off as impatient, gruff, and the type of guy who, with one glance in your direction, telegraphs, "Get to the point already." My family style is to tell stories the long way, to be loud and expressive with lots of commentary and banter. We just sit around and go, "So what else is going on?" Casual. Scott can't take more than 22 words at a time. Lana was really good with him, though, loosening up his straight-laced intensity with some sarcasm. Scott asked for the wine list. He intended to buy a bottle. At the time, I was a buy-the-glass guy. My friends and I never ordered bottles or even specified winemakers. You wanted a glass of wine, you ordered a glass. As I've come to learn, Scott is referred to as the Grape Ape, because he's like an encyclopedia of good wine. Wine lists themselves intimidated the hell out of me. The menu is leather-bound, the paper's heavy stock. At some restaurants, the wine list is so enormous, they bring it out on a pedestal with a reverent hush. The sommelier is a priest, and the wine list is the holy book with a tassel as a bookmark. As Scott perused the Chinois list, I said a little prayer that I could afford whatever the Grape Ape picked out. I went into this dinner thinking I'd pay for the meal. I wanted to do my part as host in L.A., and as the man who was trying to impress his girlfriend's parents. So Scott ordered a bottle of French wine with a long name, and then started rattling off menu items to the waiter so quickly I couldn't add up the prices fast enough in my head. To start, he said, we'll have the spring rolls, the Chinese chicken salad, the Szechuan pancakes, the ribs, and for the entree, the duck, the sea bass, pork shoulder, and sizzling catfish. And I'm thinking, oh my God, did I bring enough money for that? He ordered so much food, it was staggering. The knot of cash in my pocket wouldn't even have covered the appetizers. I thought, I'll pay for the wine at least. But could I? Scott held the wine list, so I couldn't see the prices. I devised a plan of going to the bathroom, snagging a wine list on the way, finding the bottle he ordered, and checking if I had enough cash to cover it. Despite my anxiety, we had a nice dinner. Lana's parents didn't carry themselves like snobs. They were good people who loved food and wine. Lana was constantly smiling and touching my leg under the table, letting me know she was happy about how things were going. When the bill came, the equivalent of a month's rent for me, I swallowed hard and said, can I contribute? Scott said, absolutely not, it's done. And then he changed the subject. I saw his credit card come back to the table with the bill already paid. He must have slipped it to the waiter beforehand. I have found this to be the ultimate gentleman's trick, and I have since implemented it in my repertoire. And his card wasn't plastic, it was titanium or something. The material of the credit card itself was worth more than my savings account. I was so relieved by how he handled the bill, I decided that Scott was a good guy. He was brisk but generous, and he was excited to teach me about wine. He lived up to that promise and spoiled me rotten. Up to this point, I'd go to the grocery store and pick out the $9.99 Pinot Noir. Wine didn't have a story, it just had a color, red or white. My father-in-law introduced me to a world of wine that I never really known existed. He educated me about the characteristics of wine and how much to pour in a glass, not all the way to the top. I didn't know that wine had to breathe. Who the hell knew that wine breathes? Does it have a nose? I also didn't know that it's a cardinal sin not to make eye contact while toasting. People say that sound is the only sense that isn't used when drinking wine. You smell, taste, see, feel, but the reason you clink the glasses is so the damn thing comes full circle. There is the sound. You must make eye contact to complete the sensory experience. And you better believe that I do the eye contact thing because urban legend says if you don't do this, you'll have bad sex for 7 years. Through Scott, wine became a conduit for me to learn about weather, cultures, families, and heritage. Ask me what year Napoleon fought the Battle of Waterloo? I have absolutely no idea. But ask me the best year for California Cabernet? 1996, baby. Anyway, later that night, Lana and I summed up our chinois dinner in bed. They liked you, she said. And what's with the glasses? That fall, Lana and I went back to her parents in Naples for Thanksgiving. I was under a tremendous amount of work stress, touring, management changes, and worried about yet another milestone in our relationship. I'd met with the parents already. But now I was going to meet everyone else, the siblings, their spouses and kids, aunts, uncles, family, and friends. They'd all be checking me out. Even though Simone and Scott had been great in L.A., I was concerned that the difference in our backgrounds would be even more obvious on their turf. Going to their home on the Gulf Coast, right on the water, to be scrutinized by dozens of strangers and sit for an hour-long formal family dinner triggered my anxiety. In my family, dinner seating is general admission. In Lana's, you're assigned seats like a wedding. If I wasn't crazy in love with her, I wouldn't have gone. We hadn't said the words yet, though I was bursting to do it. A few weeks before the holiday, I was doing a gig in Branson, Missouri. I got up in the morning, went to the bathroom to brush my teeth and open my mouth, and I saw horror. My tongue had some type of topography map on it, written in white fungus. It was covered with white shapes on top and on the sides. I thought I was dying and my tongue was the first thing to pass away. I don't know what was worse, that I was going to be passing away or that my final hours would be in Branson, Missouri. I didn't want to die there, so I canceled my show. One of two times I've ever done that. The other was for my daughter's birth. I landed in L.A. and my sister, a longtime Californian by then, met me at the emergency room. Once I got in to see the doctor, he informed me that it was a condition called geographic tongue, probably brought on by stress. Hearing that it was harmless and would go away on its own didn't fill me with comfort. I was constantly looking in the mirror, and every time I would get all worked up again. My tongue was still white as paste when we boarded our flight to Florida. I was blown away by Lana's parents' house in Naples. The place was huge, as expected, and beautiful. It was not like anything I've ever been exposed to before. It had a comfortable feel, but highly styled, decorated, and artful. I could see where Lana got her taste. I smiled with tightly closed lips when I was introduced to the rest of the family, making sure no one saw my tongue. I was worried people would think, the comedian doesn't smile much, does he? Lana and I were put in separate little guest home, also comfortable yet elegant. Simone had left an article from a newspaper about stand-up comedy on the bed. I came to learn that she was always thoughtful like that, clipping articles and sending small gifts. One part of my brain was going, people take the time to do this shit? The other part really appreciated the kindness. Simone made me feel welcomed and accepted. So accepted, she wasn't even disgusted by my fuzzy tongue. She knew I was sick and made me some Cornish hens stuffed with wild rice, a home-cooked meal that was a perfect remedy to make me feel better. The next day, I woke up, went to the bathroom to brush my teeth, opened my mouth, and saw a healthy pink tongue. Jewish penicillin worked! A Cornish hen saved my life. I smiled normally at dinner. Everyone talked over one another. And though I was used to a captive audience, with one person speaking at a time and others listening, I proceeded to get the seal of approval from all of Lana's relatives, blood, half-blood, and no blood. You might be thinking, well, what about your family? The tables were turned at Christmas when I brought Lana to my mom's house in Chicago. My parents were recently separated, and the family was adjusting to that. No more holiday celebrations in my childhood home on the corner lot. I immersed Lana in the Chicago experience. She hung out around the kitchen table with my family. I had all my friends over. It was a total onslaught for her, but she handled it well. When you take somebody home to your hometown, you want to show them where you go eat, what you like. I grew up on Portillo's hot dogs and hamburgers, so that was one of our first stops. She sampled a classic Chicago dog, onion, mustard, relish, and a pickle, and an enormous charbroiled burger, and she loved it all. I loved the fact that Lana enjoyed eating the food from my hometown, and we had a blast laughing while I shared stories of my childhood with my people. I gave her a day to rest her stomach, and then we went to Johnny's Beef. In Chicago, Italian beef sandwiches with peppers and juice are the thing. She never had one before, and Johnny's, an all-cast joint on Arlington Heights Road, makes the best. I ordered a sandwich with beef, with a little jardiniere peppers as well as fries, hoping she'd like it as much as I do. She absolutely loved every bite. Watching her enjoy the nostalgic places from my childhood made them new for me again. She said to me, "I like it here. Good stuff, good people." My heart sang. Back home, we went out to shovel the snow off the driveway. I was bursting to tell her that I loved her, and I intended to do it that night. While I was shoveling, I saw her making letters in the snow. I looked over to read her message. She'd written in huge letters, "Lana Hart Sebastian." It was kind of high school, kind of goofy, but that was what I loved about Lana. She got an innocent quality that I find cute and endearing. I think all artists have to retain the wonder of a child in order to create. I tend to be cynical and anxious, but then she does something like professing her love in the snow, and all my stress just drains out of me. So she said it first, or she wrote it first. I said it back, and that was it. From that moment on, we were inseparable. When I wasn't touring, I was with her. She started to come to my local gigs, and whenever possible, she went on tour with me. I went from being the Lone Ranger to a guy who was smitten. We could do anything together, work out, eat, explore, cry. Well, I'm the crier, she's not. Or go to CVS, and we were always laughing and having a good time. I continued to move up in comedy, doing specials and stand-up gigs for large crowds. Lana's career was flourishing as well. Kelly Wurstler published a design book called Hue that featured a picture of a huge 10-by-12-foot painting of Lana's. Since Kelly is very well respected, her giving Lana that validation inspired even more people to call Lana to commission paintings. She was tapped to create public artworks in the city of L.A. Eventually, Lana turned 100% of her focus on pursuing her own projects. We're still friends with Kelly. She just did the interiors at our home and converted our garage into an incredible art studio. After 2 years, I moved in with Lana. Another year went by and I gave up the lease on my one bedroom. We both loved to travel and wanted to see the world together. We just kind of bounced around for a while, going to Italy, Australia, Mexico, and Napa. We talked about next steps and always knew we'd get married and have kids, but there didn't seem to be any rush. We finally got married on August 24th, 2013, 4.5 years after our first date. We decided to have a wedding in Napa. We had a connection to the region, having taken our first vacation in wine country with Lana's parents. We did a hot air balloon ride and really kind of fell in love with the quaint little restaurants up there, the vineyards, the food, the wine, the environment. We knew early on we wanted to do a destination wedding, not Chicago, not Naples. Didn't seem right to have it on one person's home turf. We lived in California, so we would get married here. And if our guests wanted to come, we'd make it worth their while. We were adults when we were married. I was 40 and Lana was 30, so we didn't really need things. I was against registry anyway. I used to do a little bit about Italian weddings. Italians don't register at Bed Bath & Beyond. You don't bring a toaster to a wedding. Italians bring cash. We put it in an envelope. Sometimes there's not even a card. We put it in the envelope with a post-it note. Congrats. The bride and groom, they know they're getting cash. They're sitting there with a satin bag that says cash, bedazzled in rhinestones. And people walk in and they start making a deposit. Some people wait. They have the dinner, eating the chicken. Chicken's kind of dry. Food stinks here. Take 100 out of the envelope. For me, coming from where I come from, there's no wedding planner. You plan the wedding. You hire the caterer. You pick the flowers. You find the place to rent the tables and whatnot. And by you, I do not mean me. I never planned a birthday party, much less a whole wedding for 200 people. I listened to Lana talk about what was going to happen, but as far as my contribution, I went to the tailor to get the tux fitted, and I showed up. I also voted yes on having a wedding registry at Wally's Wine instead of a department store. Lana loves to collaborate, and the wedding really took off when she met Mark Freeland, the guy who did our wedding invitations. Each invitation was a set of 3 boxes, each one designed and lined. One with gingham and fake grass, one with stripes, one with clouds. Inside each one was an invite to one of the separate wedding events. The rehearsal dinner, the wedding, and the wedding breakfast the day after. The overall wedding theme was the art of love, and each event had a theme. Our love is surreal, isn't it romantic? Take love to the streets. And a symbol that was relevant to Lana. For example, the butterfly in the wedding invite box was about her father. At his funeral, they released butterflies, and she associates them with him. The location was a private home abutting a vineyard. The woman who owned it was a glamorous Italian socialite in her 60s, a big personality, a Sophia Loren type. She rarely, as in almost never, rented out her grounds for events unless she liked you. So my wife went up to meet this woman, and of course, she liked Lana. Everybody likes Lana. My wife admired photos of her and gushed about the French provincial home, and the cypress trees and the pool. She and her husband were serious art collectors, and the yard was strewn with large sculptures, modern, Very much to Lana's taste, too. Long story short, she agreed to let us have our wedding at her beautiful villa. I knew a lot of our guests had to make the wedding their fall vacation because they had to pay for flights and hotels. It was a lot to ask, and we were sensitive to that. I wanted my groomsmen, my five best friends from growing up in college, to stay in the same hotel as me, the Solage in Calistoga, so we could hang out during the day at the pool. The first night was an intimate dinner for just family at the Napa Valley Reserve, a private winery my father-in-law belongs to. The rehearsal dinner was on the second night, a Friday, at the Solage. Lana and Mark figured out a way to project images on the walls of the space, like clouds and cartoon versions of our family and friends. After the meal, Lana and I sat in a lip-shaped couch, and we were the targets of a roast, emceed by my comedian friend, Russell Peters. 4 or 5 months before the wedding, I saw him at the Comedy Store, and he said, "My gift to you, I will DJ the wedding." He does that on the side, but it could be his main gig, he is so good. "We're having a band," I said, "but if you want to DJ the rehearsal dinner and be the MC, that would be great." So he flew in on a private plane that day and flew out after the party that night to make his gig in Vegas. He did that all on his own dime. Now that's a good friend. Russell is like the Indian Don Rickles. His comedy is making fun of people, so he was the perfect guy for this event. There were drinks and amazing hors d'oeuvres, dancing, and then our closest friends roasted us and toasted us. My mom was hysterical, my sister killed, my dad's speech went over like a fart in church. For whatever reason, when he gets in front of people, he becomes a shell of himself. Lana's sisters went up. My friends raked me over the coals. John Petrelli told the story about our first date and how Lana didn't talk. That got a lot of laughs. When the roast was over, unbeknownst to Lana and me, a wave of Vegas showgirl types had been hired to come out with those cigarette trays tied around their necks. But inside were copies of a mock People magazine, with Lana and me on the glossy cover. Inside were all the regular people columns and the features and design, but all of it was about us and our lives, every photo and article. The ads were about us, with our pictures. Even the crossword puzzle was about us. The magazine was a labor of love by Lana's sister, Heather. If the editors of People saw this, they'd hire her on the spot. Months before, she sent out a questionnaire to our guests, asking for photos and ideas for this project. Questions like, "What's your favorite Sebastian moment?" When Heather is on any project, she's a woman possessed. But this was mind-blowing. She wrote it all, did the layouts, and had it printed so everyone could have a copy. This effort was above and beyond the call. There was so much love and so much enthusiasm for us from everyone there. It wasn't one of those superficial events where you invite people because they're so-and-so. Everyone there was a close friend or family, and they were being treated to this wonderful weekend. The wedding was on Saturday. Alone, I put my tuxedo on and did my hair. Then Eric Henning, my old friend and best man, and Rodney, Lana's brother, picked me up to drive me to the estate. I remember that day being hot, so we gave out white parasols so people wouldn't bake in the sun. The huppah and chairs were set up in the backyard. Lana had designed the huppah decorations of hanging bouquets and glass globes. Underneath it stood the rabbi and the priest. We are not very religious, but we wanted to have both of our religions represented. We found these two men who work as a team. While I watched the procession of flower girls and the wedding party and waited for Lana to come out in her dress I hadn't seen yet, but knew she spent 3 days in New York shopping for, I wasn't nervous at all. I felt only excitement and happiness. I could not wait to be married to her. Finally, Lana appeared on the lawn in a dramatic white dress by Giambattista Valli. She looked like she was floating on a feathery cloud with a 40-foot-long train. I choked up as soon as I saw her and was on the verge of crying for most of the ceremony. We wrote our own vows. Mine were, "Being in Napa, I think it's fitting that a bottle of wine is much better